This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Celeste Quinn is away. I'm Tom Rogers. Well, we warned you this morning that if you want to listen to this hour of the Afternoon Magazine, you might want to watch what you eat. If you did eat, chances are it was much more appealing than the foods we are about to discuss in this hour. But when these foods made their debut to the American public, they were meant to be models of fine dining, and they were often used to promote the food's ingredients. Well, today, a columnist and author is out to show just how terribly misguided that effort was. A few years ago, James Lilacs composed a website called The Gallery of Regrettable Food. It was devoted to showing the badly colored pictures and give a slightly skewed background of the foods in their host cookbooks. You could find lovely pictures of fat-laden slabs of grayish meat, frightening jello molds, casseroles that can only be described as unidentifiable. Well, the website spawned a book of the same name, and James Lilacs joins us on the Afternoon Magazine today to talk about that book. You are welcome to join in the conversation as listeners. Our numbers are 333-9455 in the Champaign-Urbana area and 1-800-222-9455 out of the local calling area. 333-WILL in Champaign-Urbana, elsewhere 1-800-222-WILL. James Lilacs writes a regular column for the Minneapolis Star Tribune and is a syndicated columnist for Newhouse Newspapers and is also the webmaster of the popular website Lilacs.com, which gave rise to the Gallery of Regrettable Food. Thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Well, thank you, Tom. How are you?
Very good. The inside jacket of the book, the first thing that's mentioned was the question, what were they thinking?
Yes, they were probably thinking, what's for dinner and what are we going to do with this slab of starch and this slab of lard here and this single grain of pepper. We've got to find some way to feed the family on this. I don't know what they were thinking.
Yeah,
every time I look at these pictures anew, when I look through the galleries for the gallery, when I look through the website stuff before I put it on, I would just pause for a moment and wonder how anybody under any context in any civilization at any time could say, boy, that fat, slathered, glistening piece of gray brains on toast looks like something I really want to eat, not just today, but tomorrow and the next day after that. I don't know what they were thinking, but I'm glad they did it.
Were we actually eating this as kids and our parents and grandparents were making this stuff?
I think so, yes. It's one of the recipe books, as a matter of fact, the foundation of the entire collection was a book that my mother had that was given to her by the North Dakota Durham Wheat Growers Association. I just sort of imagine somebody showing up in the official mufti, the whole uniform of the Wheat Growers Association, handing her this pamphlet as, you know, giving her a little wink, like, these are your instructions now. This is what you'll be feeding your family.
Salute, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think my mother just told them to take a flying leap, because that single book she pressed deep into the cupboards under other cookbooks and towels, so that when I fished it out 20, 30 years later, it was a pristine example of what people have been cooking back then. And there's not a dish in it that's edible. There's all of these odd sputum-bedecked bricks of coagulated macaroni that you throw some ketchup over.
They all had pasta.
They were very big on that, because pasta was one of those things in which you could use to fill up somebody without actually providing a flavor experience. Flavor, I think, was just regarded as the same way the Taliban regards, you know, card playing and singing. It was just, there was something morally suspicious about it. So all of these dishes filled you up, but they contained no flavor whatsoever.
Spice
my mom,
is not
however,
good for
didn't
the
do this stuff. My mom was adventuresome, and we'd even have there'd be a little cheddar cheese once a month.
Wow.
There would be sometimes Heinz 57, which was unimaginably flavorful when all you're used to is ketchup. So she dabbled on the wild side a bit, and I'm glad to say that while a lot of people ate like that in the 50s and 60s, I think I was luckier than most.
You got more than a grain of pepper.
Yeah, I got 2 grains of pepper.
All right. How did this transform from that recipe book into what we see and experience today?
Well, remember when the web was just starting out and people thought it actually had a future? There was a time when everyone was putting up a home page, and once you'd put up your home page, you had to put up something there, or it was just hi, here I am, here's my dog, here's a link to Yahoo. And so I came up with the idea of just scanning this book. And actually, I didn't at the beginning, didn't even scan it. I took a camcorder and took still photographs of all the pictures and put it up. And in the early days of the web, of course, anybody who had anything up got an award for this or that or the other. So I started to accumulate a few awards and decided, maybe there's something more to this. I started collecting the books for another version of the website, put that up, and that led to 10,000 people sending me their favorite books. And once I'd accumulated enough web traffic, I was able to go to a publisher and say, this might not be a money-losing idea like my other ones. And Crown agreed. So, I mean, it's one of those backwards things. Usually things are successful in print and migrate to the web and die a dog's death. This was fun on the web and actually staggered into the real, you know, analog physical world, and happy it did.
Now, the pictures that we see are straight from the cookbooks. They have not been retouched. They've not been, you know,
no
colors have been added to make them even more unappealing than they are.
Oh, heaven's sakes. I mean, like, a lot of these books have been slumbering unopened for 20, 30 years, so when you open them up, you're almost blinded by some of the colors. I mean, meat not ought to be this lurid in some of these pictures. I don't think they so much, some of these steaks that I have, that, you know, they may have waved them towards a flame at a distance of 6 feet. That was it. I mean, some of these things are so alarmingly pink, you don't see colors like that outside of a, you know, medical school textbook on how to detect when the viscera's gone bad or something. I mean, it's just not colors you want to...
There are a couple of meat pictures that are pretty gray, though.
Yeah.
So it's either one way or the other.
Yeah. Well, brains are gray. That's one of the things that really was the most instructive to me. I can understand casseroles. I can understand Jell-O molds. I grew up as a Lutheran in North Dakota, for heaven's sake. Every Sunday we trooped down to the church basement where there would be some little vegetable that had been, you know, killed 2 years ago, put in a can, ossified, hauled out, and then entombed in this wiggly mass. You know, that was the food I grew up on. But brains, no. I found this cookbook. I think it was one of your basic Brains for Victory, or, you know, Dead Vegetables for Victory, or something like that. World War II, not a lot of meat about.
Stuff you had to use them.
You had to use everything. You had to use the tongue. You had to use your filtration glands. You had to use your thyroids. You'd have diseases. You'd have recipes in there like
that. Was the result.
Exactly. You know, I don't know, you know, pig sphincter mousse or something like that. But when I found actual brains, a recipe for brains on toast, I thought, you know, I don't want to live in a world necessarily where brains are an acceptable menu item. If a comet comes down and wakes the dead, and they come to your house in the middle of the night screaming for brains, that's one thing. I've seen the movie. I'm used to that. But Mom and Dad just sitting down in the little kitchen, Mom with her gingham apron, Dad with a Sunday best suit on, and everybody smacking their lips over a nice steaming plate of brains.
On toast.
Is not an America that I necessarily want to live in.
The variety meats.
Yeah, variety meats.
They managed to find a euphemism for just about everything.
You know, I think the rule of thumb should be this: if there's any way that they're modifying the word meats, you're in trouble. if they have to say anything like pretty fresh meat or reasonably new meat, just find another source.
But they did find. I mean, as I mentioned before, a lot of these recipes were actually promotions for the products, or for the stuff that you're supposed to put into these things.
Yeah, you'd have the North American Beet Guild, for example, and they would put out a pamphlet that would endeavor to explain how beets could be used in every possible step of the cooking process. How you'd have beet juice for breakfast, and beet pancakes, and some nice beet-flecked eggs, and then for lunch, why, it's a delicious beef cutlet, or, you know, beet cutlet sandwich, or something like that. And they would go to these extreme, ridiculous extremes to find a way to apply these products.
All of which could be applied to a Jell-O mold.
Every single one of them. Eventually, everything ends up in a Jell-O mold. I mean, nuts and bolts, shavings from the floor, pet hair. I mean, you can just put it all in a Jell-O mold.
Jell-O must have made a killing back then.
They did. They did. And they were, it's interesting, some of the books from the 20s and 30s, which I didn't put in there, had all these wonderful sophisticated, you can find them on the website, incidentally, the outtakes. You have these wonderfully sophisticated tableaus of these Leslie Howard characters sitting around talking to these women about Jell-O, don't you know, honey? And it's this sort of upper class thing. You know, men in suits at a buffet discussing, you know, Jell-O. Oh, look, Jell-O. Here I say. Tired of those cliches, those eclairs and Napoleons. It's Jell-O, old chap. And then in the 30s, it still has this sort of veneer of a real treat that the upper classes
class
enjoy,
yeah.
Which we never think of Jell-O as really being, you know, Donald Trump style treat.
Lost its cachet.
Yeah.
What is it, if you look through the book, is there something that you would consider most frightening in this? If there is somebody, if you wanted to direct somebody to one picture,
yeah, I think it might be in the meat department.
Yeah.
There is. My favorites are in there because there's a particular cut that really looks like it's been braised with smoker's phlegm, I think is the name of it. And you have all these pages of really manly meat, and then there's a page of one roast that is inexplicably wearing lingerie. I mean, it's like it's got this frilly little thing around its leg. That meat book is just, that's the one that really alarms me. Because it still smelled of meat. This thing had been in somebody's drawers or cupboards for 30 years.
And it had been used.
And you could still smell the meat on this thing. It was just amazing. I mean, if I'd had my way, I would have been able to impregnate the pages of the book so that as you open them up, small ampules in the spine would have burst and given you a sort of a headier
scratch
aroma
and sniff,
of the neat experience.
We laugh at these pictures, though, but, I mean, these were all done very innocently, and there's a lot of innocence in this book.
Oh, that's why I love it. A lot of people mistake this as my attempt to revive the past and then beat it to death again. And it is cruel in that respect that these pictures really can't defend themselves. But this whole thing comes from a love. I'm fascinated with the whole post-war period. The combination of you have this nexus of rising technology, of affluence, of mass market, of culture. It's a pretty nifty time to understand, to get to know. Now, when I have an upcoming book on the 70s, that's going to be a pure, bitter, acrimonious labor of hate. That one you'll see. I mean, when I hate something, you'll tell.
What's wrong with the 70s?
Don't get me started. We'll have another interview when that book comes out. It's ugly. It's ugly. The music was bad. The politics were bad. The future looked grim. You know, every single movie that we had told us we were either going to die like the Omega Man or it was an era devoid of heroism, glory, taste, color. Just don't get me started.
You did mention a slip of 70s picture in the book, too.
I did.
Which, of course, is related to Jell-O again.
To Jell-O. Oh, right. Well, it was part of a much larger project which actually shows the decline of Western civilization through the medium of Jell-O cookbooks, how they started out in the 20s as being so elegant. And by the 70s, they just have these horrible tableaus where everyone, you know, the house guests look like Gomez Adams, and everyone's sideburns go down to the bottom of their chins, and their lapels are so wide you can practically, you know, walk across them in a day. I mean, it reaches that era of consummate âge du mérite ugliness that was 1973, 74, 75. But the 50s and the 60s, there's a lot of sharpness, there's a lot of coolness there, and part of the book is an affectionate jibe at that period.
Well, is there going to be a time when we once again think of the 50s and 60s as not so cool?
Do we
go through cycles here in sociology?
Perhaps so, but maybe not. I tend to think that it was, you know, that the 50s... In the 60s were regarded as uncool because the boomers, the most self-important, fatuous, and tiresome generation to ever come along, decided that human history had to begin with them. So human history had to begin with, the Beatles, and the first time they ever got lucky in a rec room somewhere while listening to the Birds. Prior to that, everything was stupid, Nazi, and Harriet, man. So, I mean, we had to go a long ways toward reclaiming a certain part of American culture that was held in contempt or regarded as kitschy. By people who just didn't understand it because it was their parents' time. So, you know, once the infection of the boomers has been fully drained from our society, I think we'll have a good shot at an abiding respect for the post-war culture. And, I mean, this whole swing thing that we went through is just an example of that. Mm-hmm. Brian Setzer, for God's sakes, God bless him, wonderfully musician, understands exactly what was incredibly cool about this era. The era of the period before the 60s was an era of substantial style, substantial cool.
But we tend to, like, I mean, we don't hear many swing records now.
No.
I mean, it was a three- or four-year thing, and then poof.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. I mean, I watched that come and say, well, it's fun that we're doing this, but the clock will go around, and we'll go right back into some horrible Brady retread fashion, you know, which we promptly did. I mean, I look at the Gap now, and every time I walk in the Gap, I want to grab the kids there, and I say, look, I wore this stuff so you didn't have to, okay? You know, those who don't remember the past are doomed to pay $57 for it again at the Gap someday. I mean, this is all the Peter Brady collection here. This is all the stuff they were wearing on Match Game 73.
That is stuff my mom bought me.
Yeah, I mean, I mean, it all smells like Charles Nelson Reilly's pipe smoke.
James Lilix is our guest on the Afternoon Magazine. The book is The Gallery of Regrettable Food. Your questions, comments, observations on the era and whatever are welcome. The number is 333-9455 if you want to give us a call. Outside the area, 1-800-222-9455. Mention product placement, and one thing that I've seen several pictures for is 7-Up.
Mm-hmm.
Things that we'd use 7-Up for that just don't fit.
Yeah. There's cooking with 7-Up, which, again, most people don't really think of with sodas.
Yeah.
But there it is. There's a picture of a nice manicured 50s hand pouring some 7-Up into a bowl of cake mix. And again, when people think cake, they don't necessarily think of a lemon-lime uncola-based substance. But throughout the entire book, there it is. How to use 7-Up in your fish batter, in your casseroles, in your omelets, in your crankcase, in your marital relations. I mean, it's 7-Up has a function and a purpose for everything. And, you know, and of course I talk to people, and they look at me from that era, and they say, well, of course we did. You know, we would pour this stuff in, and it would make good batter. It would be crazy to say that we didn't.
Just replace water with it.
It just looks odd to modern ice to be pouring some sugary lemon lime water into your cake mix. But they did. And again, it's just one of those things that once you lose that cultural connection, once nobody you know does this and it falls out of favor, then what was perfectly normal to the prior generation looks really peculiar to you.
Let's take a call. We have a call on line one in Urbana. Good afternoon.
Hi. I have more of an observation. I know that you guys are talking more about a specific era, but my husband and I, in recent, I would say the last couple of years, have noticed on TV, part of the reason why I decided I wanted to listen to this was because you're talking about how food looked gross in pictures. And I've seen, like, in our local restaurant ads, you know, when they show the waitress putting the food down in front of patrons at one of our local restaurants, and then they actually show the food with the price in the corner, and it's like the most vile-looking food I've ever seen. And my husband and I have been sitting, scratching our heads, trying to figure out who would go and eat at a place that would actually, I mean, it's the same thing that you're talking about, the weird colors, the placement of the food on the plate, the way it's cooked, it's just gross.
Bad lighting.
Yeah, I mean, it's awful. And are you based in Minneapolis?
Yes, I am.
I used to live up there. Do they have those food ads for like Ember's Restaurant or whatever?
Oh, that's a whole different story. Yes, they do. And in some of these places, they're selling you quantity. If you get this much stuff for this amount of price, they've packed the plate with it, and people don't necessarily say, "Boy, it looks like good food." They say, "Boy, that looks like a lot of food."
Right.
And for some people, the quantity of food stuff is the primary
choice. I'm just remembering this one ad that, I mean, we still laugh at it whenever it comes on, and they're showing this little girl who's kind of overweight, like spooning cheese sauce, mm-hmm. you know, into her mouth, and it's just like, "Oh my God."
And there again, you're going for the demographic that really likes the idea of cheese sauce as a primary component of your meal. If we were to open up a restaurant around here, for example, that had tanks of cheese sauce under high pressure with hoses attached to them, and we promised that you could go in a conveyor belt and we'd just blast you full of cheese sauce until you'd had enough, we'd make $1 million.
Right.
And it's not the people who necessarily want a delicate and refined food experience. They just want lots of food.
Yeah. No. Well, I just think that's kind of made the jump from old cookbooks now to fast food or sort of fake fast food mm-hmm. ads on TV, at least in local markets.
One of the things that's poisoned me forever to, for example, a lot of ice cream commercials, is that somebody explained to me that ice cream is very difficult to photograph in these circumstances mm-hmm. because of the incredibly high, you know, quantity of light you got to dump on the picture. It melts. So they don't use ice cream. They use mashed potatoes.
Right.
So every time I see somebody pouring butterscotch sauce or chocolate sauce on mashed potatoes, I suddenly lose my desire for ice cream.
So you think that food and cookbooks now look better because there's better lighting and better...
It's two things. There's a more sophisticated aesthetic taste at work, and secondly, there's better technology for color separation and printing. A lot of this stuff was mass market. A lot of it was in magazines that didn't have the kind of nice stock that we do today, so it looks weird. And today we just have a little better technology. And I also think that we're less inclined to accept an endless parade of greasy cheese-based casseroles.
At least some of us are.
Well, the magazines that my wife subscribes to and the cookbooks that we have are all pretty good. There's, mm-hmm. there's very little in there that makes me sort of reach for the counter to steady myself. So I think we're kind of out of the woods on that. But every time I pick up an issue of Better Homes and Gardens recently, I see color schemes, I see interior decorating schemes that rival anything that we did in the 70s. So, I mean, the wheel turns around
again.
It's
coming back.
Well, thank you very much.
And thanks for your call. You are also a commentator, it says in the sheet here, for the BBC.
I used to be, yes.
What are they asking about our food? And what right do they have?
It had to do with, of course, the Gallery of Regrettable Food. They wanted to do an interview, and at the time they were expanding their show to go another hour and were casting about for all sorts of American voices to provide a window on this fascinating, endlessly kaleidoscopic Yank universe. And they gave me food. And, of course, not knowing that I know absolutely next to nothing about food. And
a consumer.
I have been in my life, I have been a food commentator on the BBC. I have written books about food. I've written mystery novels in which the protagonist was a food critic. And I have been a food critic. And I'm perhaps one of the most asbestos-pated, proletariat taste people you'll ever find. How I keep lucking into these food jobs is just shows what's wrong with the industry.
That may be what they're looking for.
But they wanted information on American food trends and what was new and interesting and wacky and all that. So I did it for a while until I just finally got tired of having to be by the phone at 7 o'clock every Thursday and bowed out.
Did Did they? I mean, did you get any response back from them? What did they say when they hear about what goes on here in food?
Oh, we would just talk for 5 minutes about absurdities of flavorings and whatnot. It was just a little segment we went to. How it managed to go for 2.5 years is still extraordinary. But as you probably know in this business, once something is in place, inertia, it makes it difficult to dislodge it.
I'm sure it wasn't entertaining 2.5 years, though. Back to the book. There are a couple of other sections I wanted to point out, and you not only look at the pictures in the books, but you also look at some of the advertising campaigns.
Mm-hmm.
One that carried on for a few pages was the Spry campaign back in the 40s. Aunt Jenny.
Mm-hmm.
How did this what's the origin of that?
I don't know. She was this Bea Benaderet. Who was the woman who ran Petticoat Junction?
Bea Benaderet.
Bea Benaderet. She was that sort of character. She was rustic. She was obviously childless, barren, but man, could she cook. And Aunt Jenny was the public face of for Spry cooking stuff for 20, 30 years or so. Now, whether or not she was beloved, I have no idea. I tend to doubt not. I think she was just
more like forgotten.
But there's always that strain that rustic baking is superior to the baking of the people in the big cities. You know, with their skyscrapers and their jazz and their bootleg gin. And you don't trust them. You want real, honest bacon of the country. You go to the byways and the highways. So there's sort of this Ozark taint to her. There's this, and this. The more the booklets went on, years and years and years and years. Aunt Jenny would be involved in a variety of situations where she would counsel miserable newlyweds whose entire marriages were in danger of falling apart because of their inability to construct an adequate pie crust. She would talk to the mailman who just obviously was just showing up because he, you know, had a thing for Jenny, but would, you know, have to do with her cookies. And on it went. And so I just collected a whole bunch of these and sort of pieced together the life of Aunt Jenny and
speculated. Begged for a storyline.
Right. Speculated on her role in the community. And it's on one hand, it's what you get when you've got a guy with a lot of time on his hand. I don't think since the birth of my daughter I really would spend a week and a half idly wondering about the vicissitudes of Aunt Jenny's life. But at the time, it was something I enjoyed doing a lot, taking these small little bones of popular culture, especially dead popular culture, and attempting to reconstruct something from it. So that's essentially what this book and the website are about.
I was going to say the theme of the website is a larger theme.
Oh yes. Oh by God! I mean, don't start talking to me about larger themes, or then I'm going to get windy and pretentious, or more so than I have already, and really spouting off on the meaning of it all. But yeah, that's part of it.
This is public radio. You're allowed to do that.
Oh, you're right. You're absolutely right. Especially when you have been, as your one of your sponsors is liquor. But man, I don't know how you guys pulled that off, but congratulations, and it's fine stuff too. No, part of the fun of this is to take all of these leftover bits of detritus that have just washed up on the shores from, you know, usually in the form of Life magazines and cookbooks and whatnot, and try to reconstruct, if you can't reconstruct a period from them. As I've said elsewhere, trying to reconstruct an era from simply its commercial leavings is like trying to reconstruct a snowflake from a drop of water. There's no way you can get to the complexities that are involved.
It was all idealized
back then. Precisely, and nothing demeans an era more than to idealize it. To understand it, you gotta understand what it's all about. But as far as these cookbooks, these stories, these Aunt Jennies, these ads and whatnot, I just have a great deal of fun extrapolating meaning from them that may not have been intended by those who did them. Now, we like to pride ourselves as being the originators of the era of irony, of the era of double meaning, of the era of sarcasm. I'm not sure that is exactly true. I'm pretty sure that that people were able to see double meanings and laugh about these things in those days, too. So I'm not exactly saying that I'm adding something to these things that wasn't there by the people who created it.
It was never published, though. They never published a lot of irony back then.
No, they didn't. And that's why I'm injecting it retrospectively.
Was it bad back then? I wonder. Was it un-American or what?
No, it was just a more plain spoken, straight ahead culture, as far as I can tell. I mean, there are elements of it always. I mean, you go back and you look at the humor of the 20s and the 30s, and you're gonna find a Mencken. And on the radio, you're going to find ironic voices. They may not be what we consider to be ironic voices today, but they fit the age's definition at the time. But the whole culture as a whole wasn't suffused with this self-referential media savvy self-awareness that we have now. So people were more interested in entertainment as opposed to entertaining you with, quote, entertainment, end quote, you know, that whole sort of over-the-top self-referential Seinfeld-esque stuff that we've had for the last 10 years.
So innocent age back then.
Yeah, well, no, I don't think so. Nothing drives me crazier than hearing America lost its innocence on 9/11. I thought we lost our innocence in the assassination of Kennedy. And prior to that, I thought we lost our innocence when we were attacked. I mean, there's a wonderful passage at the beginning of one of James Ellroy's novels about the fact that the country really has never been innocent, and it demeans the people who were involved to pretend that they were. I mean, if you look back to World War II, it's fascinating to see the domestic iconography in the ads compared to the reality of what was going on in the world at the time. And you can say, well, what do they have? Their head in their sand? Were they oppressive? Do they just not want to know the truth? They said, no, in a world where you really, really have horrible things happening, stuff this saccharine actually takes on a great more significance to people.
We're getting the escapism now.
Weeks to come.
You are a columnist. You have to put out, a daily product or however regular periods. Mm-hmm. And you're a humor columnist.
Yes.
How did you re-inject humor after what's happened? What kind of a process is that? How do you think about, when do I start trying to get people to laugh? How do I start laughing?
I waited a couple of days, and first of all, my general opinion after 9/11 was that if I never write anything humorous again, I don't particularly care. I wasn't worried about what was going to happen to my career because if humor all of a sudden isn't what people are interested in, I'm certainly not interested in providing it because there's nothing funny going on here. Mm-hmm. But Gene Weingarten, who's a writer for the Post and a brilliant humorist in his own right, has said that in times of fear, people want to laugh. They do, and they especially need to laugh as a release, especially about the things that are actually making us nervous. So what I've tried to do in my local column here, which runs three times a week, is to, at first I just, the column, I should explain, is sort of the technical and BS media term for it is an interactive reader column, which means people write me letters and I address their letters. I essentially answer my email in my column and get paid for it. Mm-hmm. And so for the first week, we discussed how things had changed, how normal was being redefined, where people were and whatnot. And through that, I was able to occasionally inject some levity until I was able comfortably to sort of turn up the volume on that and then address what we're all thinking and going on with some pretty black humor. And I think the Times kind of call for that. It would be dishonorable, I think, to pretend that this hasn't happened and to keep writing happy little funny bunny, neighborhood humor columns would just seem grossly inapt. So I've tried to write about this, but write about it in a black humor way that people can find some release in, or at least know that they're not the only ones worrying about these things.
Did you find yourself adding a little more than a little more day by day, column
by
column, or was it, okay, we're done?
Yep, pretty much.
You can laugh again.
Adding, and every one of them has just been a groping in the dark, frankly. Mm-hmm. You just have to, after X number of years of doing this, you have to figure that it's probably all right to trust your instincts and this is going to work. And if it doesn't, you'll know pretty fast.
Are we headed for an era of black humor then, you think? Or?
We're headed for it. We've always had a lot of black humor, but I think it's been toothless, and I think it's been the sign of people who regard a certain cynical pose as the only pose that an educated person can have. And I think that's changed a bit. I think now this flip cynicism for the sake of flip cynicism looks stupid. It looks stupid in this culture. I think things which look faux fashionable nihilism look stupid in this culture when we've come up against the face of what actual nihilism looks like. So, yeah, to answer your question, unless, of course, the answer to your question was no, I don't remember.
You could forge a no answer too.
Yeah, we could.
But your readers obviously, I'm sure, guide you in how funny you ought to be. I mean, you have in your interactive column, mm-hmm. people send you things, and I suppose you can gauge the amount of humor they want you to convey by.
Yeah, there will always be the professionally humorless people who are engaged, who have a.
You get many of them too.
Oh Lord. Who I don't know what they possibly find funny. I don't think they do. I think they fear humor. I think they have some sort of small fishbone lodged in their diaphragm that makes it actually physically painful for them to experience mirth, and so they want to extirpate it. And they regard people like me as a foe. But no, in no one's written me to say this is beyond the pale. This is in bad taste, and that's I think because I've been attempting to be careful. I mean, there's a difference between. I mean, this is I write for a mass market family newspaper. I mean, it's not exactly You know, I'm not out there busting up paradigms with my big paradigm-busting hammer every day. I mean, there's certain lines that I know I've got to stay on the other side of. Mm-hmm.
James Lilix is our guest this afternoon. He is the author of The Gallery of Regrettable Food, the website, and the book. The book is out by Crown. You also, we can talk a little bit about what else is on your website, because did you start with the food and then branched out from there into a broader look at culture, or?
Yeah, I did. At first, it was just some writings and some photos and whatnot, some archival stuff back in '95. And then one of the first things that I added was the Gallery of Regrettable Food, which was a gallery of regrettable food. That was, all the pictures were tiny. They were all grainy. Everything was scaled for a 14.4 kps download. It was the Bronze Age of the web.
User-friendly.
And then I started adding other stuff just because I wanted to. I mean, essentially the site was an excuse. It was just a big train set, an excuse to play around with fonts, to play around with graphic design, which is a hobby, and to collect stuff. I mean, enjoyed spending a wintry afternoon in a musty basement somewhere looking at Life magazines and figuring out what I could do with these pictures. So the more I accumulated, the more I put up, and the more it sort of fell into various categories. There was there is the Orphanage of Cast-Off Mascots, who are all these old commercial mascots, cheaply drawn, that shilled for products in the 50s and 60s and have now been abandoned by their corporate masters. I sort of have a place where people can adopt them. And to this day, I get mail from people who do not understand that I don't actually physically mean that I'm going to send them this mascot.
That's sending them a mascot.
Oh. And then there's a section on the Gobbler, which is one of the ugliest buildings ever created by the hand of man. It was designed by people who had obviously both their eyes put out and were simply describing things. But, it's this shag-drenched purple and pink restaurant that is the epitome of 70s style.
But they didn't do it for the sake of 70s style. This was an innocent attempt at making money. Huh?
This was the modern world. This was the future. The future was pink and purple shag rug, buddy. And in the middle of majestic gobbler land, the Gobbler was attempted to be the first motel that was actually based physically on the physiognomy of a turkey. So it looks like a turkey. And you bought turkey there, and you ate turkey there, and then you would retire for the night in any one of these slumbering chambers. It was all 8-track stereos and shag rugs. It was just god-awful. And I had one beautiful little pamphlet of it that I had taken when I stopped there once back in the early 80s. And again, on just a lazy weekend, I thought, hey, here's a website. So I put it up. And there's more and more and more and more.
And that's not too far from here. It's still up, isn't it? The
it's up, but it's been unfortunately renovated out of its hideousness into something else. I've seen pictures of it, and it just looks like they walked through with a fire hose and blasted gray paint everywhere.
What kind of effort is it to handle that website, to host it, to keep it up to date, to handle responses? Because I'm sure you get emails, based on that.
I do. Most of the work nowadays comes from the Daily Bleat, which is a Monday through Friday column that I write there that just sort of vents about this, that, or the other, and provides people with fascinating anecdotal evidence of what my dog and child are up to, which I'm sure the whole world is just on tenterhooks learning whether or not Natalie has actually learned to form a new word in the last 24 hours. So people who want that, that's there. I write that mostly for myself so that I have a record of these days, so I have a kind of online journal of what life is like and what the baby's life is like that you can read later. That's the big work. The mail, I think there's enough warnings up there to tell people that there's a really large chance I'm not going to be able to write back, because between writing something, doing the various jobs, and trying to work on the website, I have almost no time to answer mail back. If I was to take time away from taking care of my kid and answer mail, I would, I think that the bad father harpies should crawl out of hell and drag me back.
What do you get out of the site then?
I get things like this. I get the book. the whole point of it, actually, at one point I thought, there's got to be a book in here somewhere, and that's why I kept at it. And also, if as I said, 40 minutes ago, you might remember that golden age when the web actually looked like it had a glorious future ahead of it. Everybody was going to be out there. I enjoyed being, having a presence there and having this thing which was unique and germane to the web that people liked, and was free also. It's been a big thing of it. I wanted to keep it free.
You have no qualms about putting some pieces of your personal life out on for the world to see as well.
No, and it's all obviously heavily edited. Yeah. And for the sake of propriety and privacy. But yeah, I mean, it's how could I not? I mean, I've been having this conversation with people for 2 or 3 years on a daily basis about what goes on. So yeah, I'm gonna have to keep it up.
Our phone numbers once again, 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana, outside Champaign-Urbana, 1-800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 1-800-222-WILL. Well, look back at the book again, and like you say, you've put these in some themes. How does one celebrate toast? I mean, it doesn't seem like, I mean, there isn't a toast board out there, is there?
The American Toast Council? No, I don't think so. Yeah. What there was a depression. And if you look at this picture, there's a book in there that I think the title of it that I use is All the Smart People Eat Toast. Because prior to the invention of the Toastmaster, which was from Minneapolis, Minnesota, toast was a far more cumbersome and probably downright dangerous thing to construct. I've seen some pictures of 1920s toast makers. They toasted on one side, and they had an exposed element. Sitting on the, you'd plug this thing in, you put it on the kitchen table, and it would glow white, red hot. And if anybody put their hand on it, well, you know, third degree burns, blisters, salve, the rest of it. The Toastmaster was this elegant chrome enclosed device that would toast both sides of the bread at the same time. Can you imagine this? Oh, brave new world in which we live. So this book came out, and it sort of elevated toast from its humble, mundane breakfast origins to be sort of the center of these epicene rituals, where people would gather about, presumably again in tuxes and top hats and spats, and sup of toast. And there would be these elaborate boards where you would have all of the condiments. As you can see there, I think the pictures show, the condiments would be put into small little compartments, the marmalades, the jellies, the curries, the whatnot, and you would take your little toast points, and you would sample them all. This was shown as a very sophisticated thing to do. Now, whether or not anyone bought that, of course, I don't know. I can't speak for them.
If you bought all that on the picture, it would cost you about, you know, 15 cents, probably.
Probably so. But whether or not people actually put on their best and had everyone over for a toast point party, I don't think so. But the pictures make it look as though this was what the Rockefellers and the Astors were doing. They were sitting in their fine rooms. Oysters? No, no oysters for us. We're having toast tonight.
Toast Rockefeller or something like that. Another book that you found challenged chefs, I guess they are famous chefs, I don't know, to use marshmallows in their cooking.
Yes, one of the marshmallow makers, Campfire Marshmallows, apparently went to all these chefs and said, we'll pay you X amount of dollars if you just come up with a great marshmallow recipe. And so they did, and you would have all these chefs who look, all of them look like constipated Frenchmen, or they look like extremely irritable French or Italians, or stodgy, immobile Germans, and they all essentially were completely stymied by what to do with marshmallows. Nobody knows what to do with marshmallows, so they would come up with marshmallow a la marshmallow.
Have any of them had marshmallows? You tend to think they haven't.
Well, they all have this sort of amused hauteur to them, as though marshmallows, these stupid, foolish Americans with their sugary little pillows. And so they would come up with marshmallow flambé or flambé a la marshmallows or marsh flambé mellows, and it would be one stupid recipe after the other. So again, it was a case of conjecture, in my case, of taking the pictures of these gentlemen and trying to figure out exactly what they might have thought about the job put before them. I've since found, in some of the other books I've looked at, some of these chefs in other cookbooks too. So these guys were just whores, frankly. Some of these, you know, Pierre of the Ritz or Ritz of the Pierre or whatever, they, you know, wave a 50 under his face, and he'd come out for, you know, cranberries and whatever manner.
And marshmallows.
Cranberries and marshmallows, right.
You not only poke fun at some of the, you know, the appearance of the food itself, but there are little storylines you can find just in the backgrounds of some of these pictures that you've added little vignettes to.
I think that would be the old-fashioned blurbecue. That was one of the books in which, in the front action, it seems very ordinary people simply taking things out of coolers and putting them on the floor, picnic, and eating them. But in the background, there's all these strange things going on. You see fires. You see people running. I mean, you see this strange sadomasochistic rituals hinted at. And, of course, none of that's there. But it all comes down to this. The whole book comes down to this, is that every single picture in there was not meant to be thought of as much as I'm thinking about it. They weren't meant to be looked at as long as I'm looking at it. The whole culture was like that. I mean, there's all these popular, and it's the same thing with us today. The ads, the imagery that's given to us is not meant to be studied this intently. But when you do, you find fun things, and you be able to, you start to decode it to whatever particular language you want to bring to it. So, yeah, that's, I mean, I want to make it sound like the book is some, you know, steepled-fingered, glasses on the nose academic look at what these ads mean in a subcontextualized post-structuralist context. I mean, that's not it.
It's just fun.
It's just fun.
Let's take a call on line four in Downs, Illinois. Good afternoon.
Hello. I would like to have the website.
Oh, sure. It's simply, you can go to lilacs.com.
And how do you spell lilacs?
Sure. L-I-L-E-K-S.
Okay.
Now, it's in a somewhat reduced form these days because I had bandwidth charges that made me take a whole bunch of it down. But you'll see a button for the Institute of Official Cheer featuring the Gallery of Regrettable Food. And just click on that, and you'll be at the Institute.
Okay. I also, do you know of the book Perfection Salad by Laura Shapiro?
No.
It's about the turn of the century, and it's a somewhat serious work about sort of the scientific movement in food.
Mm-hmm.
But she has some wonderful things that you would love. All white meals.
Yes. Well, you know, the scientific movement, she's quite right. I mean, there's a fascinating trend toward how we were going to live better and eat better through science, whether it be Kellogg or whether it be Fletcherization or whether it be, you know, the sanitation.
And nothing to do with taste.
No, not at all. The whole post Upton Sinclair bit there, you know, with this vogue for food safety and food cleanliness, the White Castle and White Tower hamburger chains, the reason they looked so white and so sparkly was to assure everybody that this was a very clean and hygienic, sanitary place. And the reason that the grills were out front was that people could see the meat as opposed to whatever they were cooking back there out of sight. So, yes, how food changed at the start of the 20th century as it became mass marketed is a fascinating concept.
Well, you might be interested in the book. It's Laura Shapiro.
Shapiro.
Perfection Salad.
Perfection Salad.
Yes.
My mouth is watering already.
I wonder if that's how we got white flour and white sugar and all that, too. Mm-hmm. Refined and...
Mm-hmm. Well, there was a time when something being enriched was not a dirty word. I mean, people look at Wonder Bread right now and roll their eyes. How can you eat that stuff? But, I mean, at the time, I can imagine that it was actually just that. It was soft for an awful long time. It was enriched. Why wouldn't you want something enriched? You know, if you actually have better, healthier, longer foodstuffs with the addition of chemicals, why wouldn't you want that?
And chemicals are...
that's what I love about the preconceptions of the time.
And chemicals are front and center in this book, I would think, with some of these recipes.
Yes, they are. But then again, you have to think of the fabrics of the time, too. And this goes back to the 50s when the miracle fabrics were coming in. But it goes back to the 30s, too, when you had a great deal of science and technology combining to give us the textures of the future, the formicas of the future, all these vitrolite, all these brand new things that science and chemistry was inventing, new substances out of which to build our houses, new substances with which to clad our bodies, new substances to put in our food to keep it from being the poisonous slop that killed grandma. I mean, we don't have that set of assumptions anymore. So for us, you know, we want everything to be absolutely all pure and organic. And every time my wife buys all organic, you know, food for the baby, you know, if these crops had been fertilized exclusively with night soil, you know, with stuff that they got out of human latrines, that would be organic. I'm not necessarily sure that that simply because something is organic, it means that it automatically is going to be better. Neither do I have a sort of Luddite fear of science being applied to food.
You mentioned that you have outtakes on the website. Is this going to lead to a second book, possibly?
The next book, actually, as I said before, is going to be on the 70s, I think. And then perhaps we'll revisit Regrettable Food. I've been at this for so many years, I'm just really sick of it. I need about 2 years away from pictures of god-awful foodstuffs before I can go on. But the stuff that's all on the website now is actually all stuff that I wrote in the last month and a half, so I guess I still have some love for the subject in me.
James Lilacs, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, it's been a pleasure.
Your book is The Gallery of Regrettable Food. It is published by Crown, and you are the host of lilacs.com, and I'm sure that bandwidth notwithstanding, you would be welcome to have people look at your site.
Certainly. Thanks, Tom.
Thank you.